The five aggregates, if you hear the word five aggregates, it might be more clear to you. I can translate this entire word here. Pancha means five. Upadana means clinging, so where he says that, right? The five, where are we? The five categories of clinging. So that's what upadana means. And then khanda equals mass or aggregate. So everyone should see my note there on the word panchupadana khanda. Panchupadana khandha dukha. Well, this is really what I'm about to talk about, so why don't we just jump right into it? If people have questions, they can ask them. Feel free to jump in and ask questions as you like. Idang ko panabhikve dukhang arya satchang. This is the noble truth of suffering. It's the Buddha's first noble truth. So here we go, right? Everyone's getting ready for me to say the first noble truth in Buddhism is that life is suffering. This is what we read in the books, right? I don't know if anyone's heard me rant and rave about this one. But I do rant and rave because the Buddha never, ever, ever, ever said that life is suffering. Which is amazing when you read any basic text claiming to be an introduction to Buddhism. They always start with the Four Noble Truths, and the first noble truth is always life is suffering. So here we are to correct this. This isn't a atypical, this is a typical stock passage on the Four Noble Truths, on the First Noble Truth. There's nothing atypical about this. This is how the Buddha talks about the First Noble Truth. And he skips right over life. He says, birth is suffering. Well, yeah, birth is a lot of suffering for the mother, for the child. It's suffering in different ways as well. Aging is suffering. Oh yeah, we're talking about getting old here. We're not talking about just growing up. The word aging is actually a translation of jara. This word, jara. Jara, or jara, no, jara. You can take the P off. P is just an also. So the word is jara. Jara means old age. So getting old and crippled, this is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Death is suffering. You notice he skipped right over life. And so it, you know, it's kind of significant that he did, and that he didn't just forget it and leave it out. He actually never does say that life is suffering, and that's important because it's such a dismal, silly thing to say that life is suffering. It's meaningless to the person who's listening. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Yep. Check. Association with the loathed or the unloved. Loathed is maybe a strong word. Apiehi. Pia means loved or dear. It actually means dear. Someone who is or something that is dear to one. Apiehi. Apia. Apia means something that is not dear. So association with things that are not dear or not pleasing is suffering. Yeah, when you are away from the ones you love or the things you love, this is suffering. This is association, when you're associating with things that are unpleasant, when you're with people who you don't like, in situations that you don't like, this is suffering. Dissociation from the loved is suffering. Not getting what one wants is suffering. Yep. When you want something and you don't get it, And just like a baby doesn't get what it wants, suffering. In short, suffering is the five categories of clinging objects, or as we would like to say, the five aggregates of clinging, or the five clung to aggregates is probably the best, though awkward, translation that we have. The five parts of our being, or even our experience, that we cling to, that are clung to. But he's technically right. The five categories of clinging objects is fine. It's just a little bit abstract, because really what we're talking about is us. We are the five khanda. In fact, we in the commentaries they talk about a human being as being a khanda panchaka. When a Buddhist wants to talk about themselves, they say, "I'm these five aggregates. I'm a khanda panchaka." A five-some, a quintet of aggregates. That's what I am. That's what khanda panchaka. This quintet of aggregates. So we really have, we can split this into two groups or three groups and understand suffering differently. We should at least split it into two groups. Because when the Buddha talks about jati, jara, birth, old age, sickness, death, even when he talks about the other ones, he's actually talking in a more conventional sense, and talking in terms of concepts. Because death or birth, old age and sickness and so on, these are actually just concepts. And apyehi sampayogo dukho, he's talking about things, no? People, places, things. But the actual truth of the of suffering is the five aggregates of clinging, or the five types of clinging, in which is fine to say. Or the five clung to aggregates, the five aggregates of clinging. Because this is real, this is our experience. I'd like to say, I forgot to mention in the beginning, to reiterate that we're trying to make this immersive. So this session should as well be meditative. As I said before, the five ascetics, when they listened, they were also meditating, and one of them actually became a sotapanna, as listening, as a result of listening to it. So let's try and take this to heart, no? And to actually experience what we're talking about here, and look at it in terms of our experience. And this is what we deal with in the last part, the panchupadana khanda. Now, why does he use the word "in short"? This is the confusion. The confusion comes from the "in short." Sankitena does really mean "in short" or "in brief" or "in summary," you could say. And it actually does, in a sense, in terms of ultimate reality, refer back to all of the stuff that it precedes or that it follows. Jati, well, what is born? The five aggregates are born. At the moment of our conception in our mother's womb, there's rupa khanda, which is the form aggregate. There's vedana khanda, which is the feeling aggregate. There is sanya khanda, which is the memories and perceptions. There's sankhara, which is thoughts, the thoughts aggregate. And there's vijnana khanda. These all arise in the womb. Many of them are just the continuation, or they are all really the continuation of the past life. But they arise at the moment of conception, and for some beings at the moment of birth. So the word birth is actually, it's just a conventional term, but technically we're talking about the moment of conception. That's birth in a Buddhist sense. But even if we're just talking about the birth out of the mother's womb, then what we're really talking about is the five aggregates. At the moment of birth, the suffering that comes to the child and to the mother is the same as the suffering that we might experience right now. It comes from the physical stresses in the body, coupled with the feelings and the perceptions of them as pleasant or as pleasant or painful, and memories of how they're unpleasant or may cause us suffering. Then there is the judgments as good or bad, and there is the consciousness, the awareness of the physical. So when the baby is leaving the mother's womb, he suffers because of all five of these, and because there's clinging to them. There's a clinging to the way things were before birth. Birth is, I guess, a really good example, because the clinging that comes in the womb as the baby becomes accustomed to the warmth and the relative stability, and is suddenly thrust out into the cold, harsh climate outside of the womb, and forced under bright lights and loud noises and rough treatment by the doctors and so on. Relative to the womb, it's quite a bit of suffering, and this is the change that comes. And because of the clinging to the comfort and the pleasure in the womb, the baby suffers. So it's a clear example, and we can go through all of these. Old age, because we cling to our youth. And so the clinging to a youth is clinging to the five aggregates. But why I said we should split it into two is because, well, the first are just really just conventional talk. It's a way of argument. It's rhetoric, in a sense. Technically speaking, the five aggregates are enough, and that's why he comes to that in the end. As I said, a lot of this is just rhetoric, which is a very important part of any dialogue. You can't impress someone with just technical jargon. You can't reach their heart. And if you can't reach their heart, it's hard for them to give rise to the mind states that will allow them to listen to what you're saying. So rhetoric has its purpose. Of course, rhetoric can cloud the mind and can lead you astray if someone uses rhetoric in the wrong way. But skillful use of rhetoric allows one to slowly appreciate and comprehend. Because again, we're dealing with living brains. These guys have brains. They're not machines that you can just plug in a program and get the answer. So he slowly introduces the subject. What is suffering? Well, these guys thought everything was suffering, and that therefore they should abstain from all attachment to anything and just work it out by forcing themselves into unpleasantness, or try to experience all the unpleasantness here and now and get it over with. This is what many people in the Buddha's time thought. They thought if they torture themselves, they would work out all of their karma. And once that was done, they would be in total bliss, because they would have worked it all out. So the Buddha said, well, do you know how much karma you have stored up? And they said, no, we don't. Do you know how much is left? No, we don't. He's like, whoa. And so as I understand, he said, then you must have really done something very bad in the past life to put yourself in such a crazy position as this. You must have some pretty bad karma to get you stuck in such a position of never-ending torture and punishment. Because actually torture and punishment doesn't lead to happiness. It's anatta sanghito, as we talked about. So he works it out. He starts talking about the types of things that are suffering, and then he says, basically the list could go on and on and on. And anything really can be suffering if you cling to it. And so he doesn't just conclude or summarize with the last part. He actually puts a twist on it. And you can see sort of the progression. The first part is talking about things that really have nothing to do with our mind, our state of mind. And so actually, birth doesn't have to be suffering, right? Old age doesn't have to be suffering. Sickness doesn't have to be suffering. But he's just kind of, it's just rhetoric and it's just conventional talk. Actually, these things don't have to be stressful at all. And then he starts getting more to the point when he talks about sorrow, lamentation, and despair. This is funny, the translation is not the same as the English. I'm taking from two different sources, I see. The English is relating to the Vinaya version. The Pali doesn't have, anyway, none of you will probably catch it, but the Pali doesn't have the part with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair or suffering, because that says that must only be in the Vinaya. There's two versions of this sutta. This one's missing piece. Anyway, so with the part where he gets on to association with loathe, dissociation from the love, this is starting to get into clinging. Because the problem, of course, with association with that which is unpleasant and dissociation from what is pleasant and not getting what you want. Well, it's not really the not getting what you want that's the problem. It's the not getting. It's not the not getting. It's the wanting. And so that's what he comes to in the end. That's what he adds here. Is that in short, anything can be suffering if you cling to it. So this is the noble truth of suffering. The second noble truth is the cause of suffering, right? So if anyone we should all be aware of the four noble truths. Hopefully everyone has a bit of an understanding of them. The cause of suffering is clinging. We might say that suffering is inherent in every arisen phenomenon. And that technically is correct. There's two ways of looking at this. We can say that everything we experience has an element of suffering. And what this means is not that not that it is painful in and of itself or is a cause for stress for us in and of itself, but that like a fire, it's hot, right? You can't deny that fire is hot, but it's only hot if you touch it, right? It only gives rise to an experience of heat if the person touches it. So we know not to touch fire. A snake is only poisonous if it bites someone, right? The snake itself doesn't poison itself, so it's not really poisonous. But if it bites a being that can't take the venom, then we say it's poisonous. So in the same way, what we mean really by the word dukkha in this sense is that it is, in a sense, poisonous, or in the same sense that the snake is poisonous, it is painful. It is only a cause for stress or suffering. When you cling to the fire, you get burnt. When you cling to anything, it gives rise to suffering. And why this is one, because certain things are intrinsically suffering, right? Two, certain things are pleasant. And then when we cling to them and they disappear, then they're unpleasant, then we suffer. And three, certain things are comfortable, like calm and neutral feelings are comfortable, but they take work to maintain. There are three kinds of suffering. Dukkha, painful feelings are inherently suffering. I'm losing it. Losing the connection here. Okay, I think we got it back. And Viparinama dukkha, which means suffering that comes from change. When a happy feeling disappears, pleasant feeling disappears. And then sankhara dukkha, which means the suffering that comes from having to maintain, you know, just having to maintain our state in this life. People say, oh, my life is comfortable, you know, I have a nice home and you know, a stable situation. But how hard you have to work to maintain that. You know? Then they have to go to work and spend all their, the majority of their life working to just maintain that. Even people who practice tranquility meditation and their minds become calm and peaceful, well, they have to work to maintain that. And when they stop practicing, it slowly disappears. And they have to work again. Even beings that are born in the Brahma world, as gods, they have to work and work and work just to reach that state. And then they can be there for billions and billions of years. But then eventually it ceases as well, and they have to work again and again to attain it. All right, so the sound's back. I apologize. For those of you who aren't aware, I'm in the jungle in Sri Lanka. So there's a kind of an excuse there as to why our internet is not as professional as it might otherwise be. So this is a test of our patience and an aid to our practice of understanding impermanence, whatever. Okay, so here I'm talking about intrinsic suffering, that you can say everything that arises is dukkha. And we often say this, but this has to be explained. As I said, some things are dukkha because they are intrinsically suffering. Some things are dukkha because they are building yourself up for suffering when it's something pleasant and then it disappears. And some things are dukkha because they're stressful in having to maintain them. And the example I gave of a stable society or stable life that takes a lot of work. You know, we all have to work hard in the world. You don't if you leave the world, but living in the world, you have to work in a factory or in a store. You have to work and work and work just to have a stable life. Even a person who practices tranquility meditation, as I said, has to work really hard to maintain it. And when they stop practicing, it slowly goes away. So it's dukkha in this case. But the Buddha here is offering a way out. And in a sense, it's a way out that doesn't require you to leave behind reality. So Nibbana we understand to be of two kinds. Nibbana is where the defilements are gone and someone still has the aggregates. Someone still lives their life, but they just don't cling. But another person, when that person passes away, then there is this Nibbana without any kind of suffering or any kind of aggregate left over. But the point being that we can live with birth, old age, sickness, and death without having to suffer from them. It's possible. Some people can get old without suffering. And the key is because the cause, the origin of suffering, which is equally important, is the next one, is the craving. So if we talk in terms of everything arisen as being stressful or a cause for suffering, then, well, it's the craving that has caused us to be reborn, and that's what the Buddha is talking about here. You know, in the sense of a being, you know, the being is reborn because of their craving. At the moment of death, if you read up on dependent origination. At the moment of death, a person clings. They cling either to something they've done in the past, they cling to the idea of things they've done in the past, or they cling to some idea of the future that they are wishing for. And as a result, they're born in such a state, based on the karma or based on the vision of the karma that they've done, or based on the vision of their future. There are these three causes. And when because of their craving and their clinging, really, the clinging which comes from the craving, they are reborn. Of course, people who don't like to talk about rebirth can understand this in terms of this life that we're in now. Craving produces renewal of being in this very life, right? When you want things, then you build them up. We want a house, and so we enter into quite a bit of suffering in order to get our house. And often, you know, people nowadays are losing their homes, right, to foreclosures, and in America there's a big problem. And so a lot of suffering as a result. Right? So, and it comes at least in a part because of craving, but you could say it comes entirely because of craving, first because this is why we were born into this state in the first place, but also because we're setting ourselves up. Because we want something and we like it, and when we get this nice house, we feel wonderful and happy. And then when we lose it, we suffer. Even a person living homeless on the street still has the same basic experience as a person living in a mansion. You know, all of us sitting here, think of the 19, 20 of us, 21 of us with Stephen sitting here. We all have very different lives, and yet our experience of reality is very much the same. The objects of our experience. We might speak different languages or live in different cultures and societies. But here we are seeing the computer screen, and we're hearing the voice of the monk. And we're hearing in the room around us and the crickets. And we have smells and tastes and feelings and thoughts and our emotions. In short, our experience of reality is very much the same. So the only difference being is that we in the mind we have this categorization where we say this is pleasant, this is very pleasant, and this is unpleasant, and this is very unpleasant, and we categorize reality into the acceptable and the unacceptable, and as a result our tolerance level is way below what it should be, or way below a natural or a total acceptance. We have a very limited acceptance of reality. And it's due to that clinging or craving or however you look at it that we suffer. So this is the cause of suffering. Why I highlighted this one word is because I really like it. The enjoying this and that, which comes from the Pali, tatra tatra binandini. And why I like it is I really like what Mahasi Sayadaw has to say about it. I think it's quite informative and enlightening. Basically, he explains it, and I believe it's an explanation based on the commentary, is that what it means is we find delight anywhere, and it's amazing the kinds of places that beings will find pleasure. You know, if you look at human beings as an example, we'll find pleasure anywhere. The person living in the cardboard box can find pleasure and happiness and can at times be quite happy. And you might even look, do a study over time and find that the person living in the cardboard box is actually happier than the person living in the mansion. This is obviously the case in many cases. There are miserable people living in great luxury. Though it may not be clear that for anyone who's investigated it, there are people living quite happily in cardboard boxes, for example. Not quite happily, but living with some amount of peace and happiness. There are people living on the street who are able to put up with it. It's because of their lack of clinging, their lack of craving. They don't have any expectation that they're going to get rich or live in a mansion. But a person who lives in the mansion, too, if you take the mansion away from them and put them in, say, put them in a cardboard box, for example, and see who suffers more. Obviously, the person who's coming from the mansion. But the point here is that we can find happiness anywhere. But human beings are only a small part of the picture. And if you go to the link that I posted, you can go there later or you can go there now and read what he says about it. He talks about how even this dung beetle thought that it was great to be living in a pile of dung, following after her husband, the dung beetle, where previously she had been a queen. And she's like, I used to like being a queen, but now I think it's pretty cool living in this dung and this cow manure. And Mahasi, he explains about how she would be happy to slit the king's throat and wash her new husband's feet in the blood. This is apparently what she said, or what she meant to say in that story. But it's true, no? The ducks and geese and chickens, cows and pigs. There's a comic going around that I saw on Google Plus about Facebook, and it was funny to me because it's actually, though it's not what was meant by the comic, it's actually very Buddhist, and there's a Buddhist Jataka story that goes along with it. The comic is, if anyone's seen it, it's two pigs, and they're like, wow, this is great. We don't have to pay for the food. We don't have to pay for the barn. Everything's free. And the caption is what? Something like, if you're not paying, you're not a customer. You're the product. And that's Facebook and you or something like that. But the reason why it's Buddhist is the actual story behind it of the pigs. Because the problem here is that these pigs are missing something. As we, I guess, apparently are missing something from Facebook, from the picture in Facebook that we're being sold for the slaughter or something like that. But this is the story with these pigs, is that they don't get it. You know, they're being fattened up for the slaughter. And yet it's true. There's this Jataka that goes, these two cows are talking, and the ox, and they're talking, and they say, man, look at those pigs. They just sit around and do nothing, and they get fed all the best food. They don't have to work. And look at us. We get fed just grass. But look at all the work we do. How is that fair? And the other ox says, man, don't envy those two. Don't envy those pigs. He says, why? Trust me. Be content and be happy with what you've got. And sure enough, as time goes on, we see the fate of the pigs. And he realizes, oh yes, well, it's good to live an honest life then and not be like a pig. That's sort of the somehow the moral of the story. But the real lesson that comes from it is how beings can find, or the lesson in our case, is how beings can find pleasure anywhere. We find pleasure because we don't realize the impermanence of it. We don't understand the consequences of clinging. So we cling to everything, we enjoy everything. You know, we get this nice new smartphone or iPad or whatever, and it's so nice. And then it breaks or scratches, no? Drop it on the floor. We get a nice new car and then we get in an accident. Car's totaled. But what I wanted to say was just that we build up these recognitions of things as pleasant. You know, if it brings you pleasure, then even in terms of the brain chemistry, we register that. And the next time we see it, we remember that. This is why they were talking about the five aggregates. Memory comes in here. When memory comes in, we remember that it brought us pleasure, and so we judge it and we strive for it. And so beings will do this with anything. Pigs will do it with their feed. Dung beetles will do it with dung. Dogs, if you look at what the sorts of things that dogs will eat and be totally in heaven, eating the most vile of things. You know. This is how it goes with things like beer and cigarettes, no? Sex. When a person reaches puberty, right? Up until that point, it seemed kind of gross, or even engaging in it is quite disgusting at first. But because of the pleasure and the intense pleasure, it becomes quite appealing and a source of addiction or a great attraction. Beer and wine, how people become, you know, become in a sense addicted to it. But it's sort of a mental addiction. They're pleased by it, happy about it. You know, something that is like rotten grapes, no? It comes to be delicious and tasty. Coffee and all of these things. So, this is the origin of suffering. Mm-hmm. Now, in the end, he enumerates three types of desires or cravings. And this is important to understand as well, so I'll try to explain what is meant here. Sensual desire or craving for sensuality has to do with the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling. The first five. And the word is kama, kama tanha. Kama tanha is sensuality, and this is what takes up, technically speaking, this is what has to do with our human realm of existence. Humans and animals and even angels, the heavenly realms of pleasure. Because it's associated with the five senses, the five senses of sensuality. Craving for becoming or being, bhavatanha, is what takes place in the God realms. Craving for being and craving for non-being, they both take place in the God realms. Craving for being is in the form realms, the realms of gods that have a form. And so it might just be light or some ethereal body, some being that they inhabit, some physical form. So there may not be any seeing or hearing or smelling or tasting, but there is a being of sorts. They're not simply mind creatures. They might emit light or so on, but they have some form of sorts. They won't crave for, they won't eat or drink or smell or taste or feel hot or cold, but they will be happy to be something, or they will cling to this idea of being. And craving for non-being is those gods that don't have form, and so they cling only to thoughts. They cling to the state of being without form. This is technically speaking, this is what the commentaries will tell you and what is technically the case for these three. But, you know, obviously this is not of much use to us on a practical level. It's interesting theoretically and philosophically, and to think about how even clinging to becoming a god or becoming an angel or so on is still a part of clinging. But really, craving for being and craving for non-being, it does occur in this realm, and it's what leads us to you know, to become this or to become that, or to not become, to become without this or without that. And it's still a kind of a clinging, because it's a partiality. We see it in people who feel like they want to become something, you know, people who work very hard to become successful in life or make a name for themselves, people who cling to fame, for example. There's very obvious examples of this, and obvious examples for craving for non-being. People who are tall and don't want to be tall, people who are short and don't want to be short, people who are fat and want to be thin, people who are thin and want to be bulky. People who are, it's funny to see how people relate to skin color, you know, because in Asia, everyone's always avoiding the sun, right? Which is funny coming from the West, where everyone's like, oh, great, sun, let's go get a suntan. When you come to Asia, it's like, don't go out in the sun, you'll turn black, which is bad, right? Right. So craving for non-being, don't want to be this, well, maybe that's also craving for being, no? Wanting to be light-skinned, wanting to be dark-skinned. But it incorporates both. Trying to avoid being this or avoid being that. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. We all want to avoid being this and avoid being that. We want to avoid sickness, so we eat. We obsess over our food. We want to avoid ill health and health problems, so we exercise and so on, trying to avoid all of these things. And it creates stress for us, worries and stresses and all sorts of sufferings. That's the second noble truth. The third noble truth, and really the fourth noble truth, are pretty simple. The third noble truth is that when you get rid of craving, then you have no suffering. Oh, simple. Simple, but really profound. I mean, people always ask, what is, you know, how do you become free from suffering, right? I mean, this is really the goal of spirituality, the goal of religion, is to become, the goal of science as well, no? Is to become free from suffering. So here we have it. Here we have the answer to life's problem. It's amazing, no? Here it is on Google Docs. the answer. And the answer is, it's very poetic, actually, if you read the Pali. So we always chant this sutta, and it's a very chantable sutta, because it's very poetic. Ayameva, no, that's the wrong one. Yotasayeva tanhaya asesa viraga nirodho. Chago na patinisago mutti analayo. And the remainderless fading and ceasing, giving up, relinquishing, letting go and rejecting of that same craving. I'm not sure about the word rejecting, it's a bit of a quibble, but analayo is just means not finding solace in, or not resting in, because alaya means a resting place or a house, a home. Not being at home in the craving, or you know, leaving behind the craving. Good way of rejecting is okay. And the fourth noble truth is something that we've already gone over, is the Eightfold Noble Path. So here we have, actually, as we, I think this sort of led some credence to the argument that the Buddha was only using the first part of this discourse to specifically relate to the five ascetics. And that actually, technically, he should have started with the Four Noble Truths, or, you know, it's not, obviously not should have, but the reason he didn't start with the Four Noble Truths is because he wanted to make an important point that the torturing of oneself is also not the way out of suffering. But no, it's a really good introduction to the Four Noble Truths. Talking about this is, you know, there are these paths that people take to be free from suffering. One is the indulgence in sensuality. The other is the indulgence in torture. And neither of these is the way out of suffering. Why? Because, well, what is suffering? And what is the cause of suffering? And given that that's the cause of suffering, then the way out, the cessation of suffering is giving up, or the end of that craving, and therefore the way out of suffering is simply, as the Buddha explains, the Eightfold Noble Path of coming to understand and see clearly how this works. So, remainderless. Remainderless is probably not a word. I don't know. Does the spell checker... No, there's no spell checker on. Spell checker's off. Remainderless means without remainder. Without remaining. It's just a construct. You know, remainder comes from the word that which remains. No, remain. Less. Without remainder. And why he uses that is he's translating directly from Asesa. A is our friend, this negative, so we can understand a to mean not or without. Sesa just means remainder or what's left over. It's actually an interesting compound here, this whole compound, and I'm not exactly sure. I don't think there's a very good consensus on what it means. I think the orthodox definition of this term is, or translation, is the remainderless cessation through absence of desire, absence of lust. Because the word viraga is really a difficult one in this compound. Nirodha means the cessation. Asesa means without remainder. But viraga means without lust. So it seems to mean, and what it's generally translated as, the remainder or the cessation due to freedom from lust or freedom from desire that is remainderless or that is without remainder. So, but I think actually the word viraga nirodho can actually just mean the extinguishing or the cessation. It's really seems to be just an idiom that means the remainderless cessation. Where do we have here? Remainderless fading and ceasing is how he calls it. Yeah. But it really means more than that technically, because viraga means without craving or without lust, or really without lust. Asesa viraga nirodho. The word viraga is used often. It's one of these similes. Again, synonyms. Again, he's probably just dealing with the synonyms here, viraga, nirodha. In a sense, they are synonymous, or they're a progression. Viraga leads to nirodha. Viraga is the cessation, is the giving up of clinging. Nirodha is the result. So it seems to be just an idiom that means without any remainder. This is really the important part, the asesa, the word that you're asking about. That it totally gone. Because what the commentaries explain is that actually we can all enter into the freedom from suffering, right? Because or the freedom from craving, right? Because we're not always craving for things, right? We're sometimes we don't have craving. Sometimes we're really angry. No. So when we're angry, well, when we're angry, you could say we have vibhava tanha, you could say. But there are times when we're asleep or when we're meditating. When people practice tranquility meditation, for example, they don't necessarily have any clinging. Most likely in their mind, I guess technically there can't be any clinging. But it's not remainderless, because that clinging can come back. So Nibbana or Nirvana is not considered the cessation of clinging, it's the cessation of suffering. This is why we understand Nibbana or Nirvana to be outside of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. It's outside of the five aggregates. It's called Khanda Vimutti, which means it's free from any of the five khandas, or the five categories or aggregates that we talked about above. And this is what is meant by the freedom from suffering. This is what makes it special, that you can have the khandas and still in some sense be free from suffering, but you're not technically free from suffering, because the khandas in and of themselves are stressful. They are this one kind of suffering, or the source of suffering. So Nibbana is when the mind lets go and retracts, in a sense. It ceases to reach out and to grasp for anything, any experience. And it's as a result experienced as the cessation. Don't know. Something you have to experience. It's not really an easily discussable topic. So okay, there we go. We've gotten through the Four Noble Truths with only a little bit of technical difficulty. I guess maybe we can stop there, since we are over an hour here. It's great. We have 24, 25, 26 of us, give or take. People having technical difficulties on their ends. I think it's a good place as any to stop. We've covered another section, and the next section has to be explained in some detail in regards to the deep pariwatta, which we get to in Nick's. Nick gave us this note on the three aspects of the different truths. So we'll start that next week. And why I think it's a good place to stop is because now we can take questions if people have them. If people have questions about what's been discussed or something that hasn't been discussed but is related to the text. You have questions, or if you have comments, if anything I said seemed out of line or unclear, or you'd like to clarify, or if anyone has knowledge of the sutta that they'd like to talk about, if anyone has had any epiphanies that came to them, anyone wants to share any enlightenment experiences that came up during the session, you're welcome to open it up now. I really would like this to be open and have everyone participate. So I'm hoping at least there is participation in the sense that we are internalizing this, and it's actually having some impact on our understanding of our experience. And we can see when we're clinging, we can see when we're suffering, and we can see the relationship. We can see how true happiness is really actually quite simple. Not easy, but it's simply the giving up of clinging. When we're able to accept all of reality. And maybe not only accept, but we're able to let go and let be to the extent that we are able to free ourselves. Well, this is a record anyway. 23 or 24. Some duplicates. But we got over 20 viewers, 20 participants. Thank you everyone for coming. And please don't be shy if you have questions. I'm here. Stephen, do you have any questions?
I don't know if this was mentioned before.
Here, wait just a second. Let me get this mic off here. Get you the mic. Stephen has a question.
So I don't know if this was mentioned before, but in terms of the Noble Eightfold Path, I've read something about it before. Some people would say that you can partake in them in an order where you practice some of them as a foundation, as like a pillar, and then you build more and more until you reach peace. But some say that it's like the whole package. You have to do it all the time. It's not you do this and then it's not like a simple building block, one leading to the other one. It's all of them at the same time. So I'm just wondering which one is actually more effective.
Well, we did talk about this. It really points to the diversity of the Buddha's teaching. In many ways, I mean, there's the Pubanga Magga, the Magga. Let's get to the core. And I talked about this before. The core of the Eightfold Noble Path is a momentary realization. It's the moment when it all comes together. At that moment, the mind is released. You know, the moment. So suppose you're sitting in meditation and you're watching the stomach rising and falling. And then there comes a point where you experience the rising and falling to suddenly change, you know, of its own accord. So it was going slow and now it's going fast. And because you've been practicing so strenuously, and because your mind is so sharp, that catches you, and you just it's the last straw, and it's like, this is not permanent. Or maybe it becomes tight and stressful, and the rising and falling appears to be unpleasant or stressful or tense or tight, and so you see suffering. Or it happens that you're watching the rising and falling and suddenly it goes by itself. It starts to just go automatically, like without your intervention, and so you see non-self. At that moment, it becomes clear, right view arises, right? The clear and perfect, or not perfect, but well, in a sense, absolute understanding, that's without a doubt, that this is something that is stressful. I mean, it's suffering in the sense that if I cling to it, it's going to cause me suffering. This realization, at that moment, all eight path factors are perfect. There's right thought, right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood. I mean, a lot of these are no-brainers because you're not speaking, you're not acting, right? So they're all fulfilled. But there's right effort because your mind is clearly at a perfect pitch, you know, right mindfulness and right concentration. It just means perfect pitch. But that is, in a sense, incomprehensible, and it kind of makes the Eightfold Noble Path useless as a practical teaching. So then we have what is called the Pubanga Magga, which is working to get to that level. Now, the order in which you work in them, as I said last week, it varies. You know, in some places the Buddha talked about morality first, then concentration, and then wisdom. In other places, it seems like he's talking about right view first. Right view leads to right thought, leads to right speech, and really they're both the truth. It's you know, it could be that the Buddha sees, oh, this person needs to. This is what I said last week, is that some people need to focus on views. You know, they have a lot of wrong views, so you talk to them about right view. Some people are immoral, or they're you know, loose in their habits, so you talk to them about morality first. I think you actually said something that makes sense to me, is that, you know, you can work on one of them first, build up a pillar, and later on work on the other. But, you know, they do support each other. So in the end, it's like building a house. You can't build up one side and neglect the other one and say, when this one's complete, I'll work on the other ones. So first I'll work on right view, and later on I'll work on that one. Because like a house, well, you need the pillars to support the walls, and you need, you know, everything to support everything. So in a sense, they pull each other up. And you could say that for many of them, working on a single one will allow you to build up the others as well, or if they're all right. And, you know, the Buddha goes into such great detail in different suttas. In some places he talks about how, you know, concentration is supported by effort and mindfulness, and he goes in, you know, it's really quite interesting. Interesting, it's kind of philosophical or I don't know, scientific, how he goes through and details and explains the relationships, the intricate relationships between them. So you don't have to really worry either way. You know, is it all together, or is it one by one? You know, we take this as a support in our practice, that all of these things are good. And I think the way most people use them is they compare it to their lives and see, do I have right view? Do I have right speech? Oh yes, I had some bad speech there, or I had some bad actions, and so they adjust. And it's a guideline for us that eventually we adjust to the point where our path, our way, our interaction with experience is perfect. And that moment of perfection, perfect experience, leads to perfect understanding, which leads to release and freedom and bliss and happiness. Okay, first of all, I just want to answer the technical question. The record of that study, it's recording right now. So we're being recorded, hopefully. I'm being recorded. yes. And the last week's, or if you were talking about last week's study, it's already on my web blog. So my web blog is on the Sri Mangalo site at yuttadhammo.sirimangalo.org. And there's an audio page and the audio talk. It should be the newest of the audio talks. There's also a podcast feed, if you know what those are. But everything that I've said tonight should be on record, even the stuff that you didn't hear because of the technical difficulties, even the technical talk. Okay. Now, in regards to what I was saying, the observation. Well, it's interesting that you should say that right effort and right concentration lead to right mindfulness, because in some ways right mindfulness leads to right effort and right concentration. See, if a person has... a person can have effort and concentration without mindfulness, but then it's not right mindfulness, right effort or right concentration. See, they really have to go together. A person can have a lot of effort without a lot of concentration. A person can have a lot of concentration without a lot of effort. I would say one way of looking at these things is mindfulness is a way of balancing concentration and effort. And this I've talked about before in our practical meditation teachings. That's something that I believe the Buddha said, and it's certainly in the Tipitaka somewhere. That mindfulness is the one which balances both effort and concentration and wisdom and confidence. So does all of that lead to right vision? Yeah, for sure that's the case. Right view and right intention. But in some sense, a person has to have right view when they start out. At the very beginning, if a person has wrong view, like if a person believes that all they have to do is believe in God and they'll go to heaven, or all they have to do is do this ritual or that ritual and they're going to go to heaven, or so on, it's very difficult for them to begin to be mindful. Very difficult for them to see any reason to give rise to effort or concentration. Very difficult for them to practice meditation, to put it simply. And then you can also argue that without right action or right speech, a person will not have right livelihood, will not have right effort or right concentration. A person with wrong speech and wrong action will therefore be very distracted in mind. Right? A person who kills and steals, lies and cheats, takes drugs and alcohol, will not have a clear mind. And yeah, you can say that you need effort to maintain mindfulness. That's very true. With the qualifier that mindfulness shouldn't be a stressful effort. Sometimes people put in a lot of effort, but they're only developing concentration as a result, or this focused or repressed state of mind, pushing too hard. And when you push and push and push, you just repress the emotions. Mindfulness should be actually like dancing. It's like being with the experience and kind of dodging or boxing with it. No, you have to learning to get in with the rhythm of it, not misstep and fall into craving or aversion. Is there anything to be done or upheld for arahants who enter into Nibbana after death? Could they slip down to lower states again like gods? And is Nibbana non-being, or is that in regards to, not in regards to Nibbana? Some serious philosophical questions. No, good Buddhist questions. Well, the difference is, on at least a very simple level, is that the reason why it's suffering or it's sankhara dukkha, this suffering caused by having to work hard, is because the God realms are not based on wisdom at all. They're based simply on concentration. They're based on the lack of attachment to sensuality. Lack of attachment to sensuality can come based on two things. It can come based on concentration, when you focus the mind and repress your desires. And this is what people will do when they practice tranquility meditation. Or it can come about through wisdom. So a person who reaches, say, the anagami stage, where they have rooted out all desire for sensuality, still has craving for becoming and non-becoming, still has craving for, still has the attachment to being this or being that, and not being this and not being that. As a result, they too are born in, if they don't become an arahant in that life, they too are born in the God realms. But they're born in a certain specific type of God realm that is a classification of beings that aren't liable to fall back, because their freedom from sensuality is based on wisdom. It's not something that disappears. It's based on the epiphany that is comprised of the experience of Nibbana. It's this realization which changes the core of their being in a very intrinsic way. And so that's really the difference here, the difference between an arahant and a person who practices, who is in the God realm, is that one is based on, better to compare the anagami, no? The anagami is in the God realm because of wisdom, and the other is there because of, anyone else is in the God realm only because of their suppression of the defilements, not the eradication of ignorance, or the based on the knowledge. An arahant has perfect and complete knowledge of suffering, of the Four Noble Truths. And so they can never give rise to any kind of craving or clinging, even for being this or being that, or not being this or not being that. It's comprehensive for them. And it's totally based on knowledge. It has nothing to do with, nothing. It is not simply because of concentration. Although their mind has to become very focused to attain the wisdom, their mind is subsequently always focused, eternally focused, because of the wisdom and the understanding. It's kind of a wisdom that none of us can relate to because we haven't experienced it. You know, even what we call wisdom disappears because it's just based on intellectual or mental activity. But the realization of Nibbana is something in a whole other category, because Nibbana is khanda vimutti. It's free from seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking, body, feelings, memories, perceptions, thoughts, and consciousness. So the question is, Nibbana non-being? It's a bit of a slippery question. There is no being, right? So that's one way of avoiding this question. You know, everything is non-being, because a being is just a name. But Nibbana is the non-arising. So in that sense, you could say it's non-being, in the sense that there's no arising of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, or thinking. There's no arising of rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, or vijnana. So you can understand that as you like. It's simply when all of these things, which are impermanent, unsatisfying, and uncontrollable, cease to arise. You know, here they are arising, ceasing, arising, ceasing, arising, ceasing, incessantly. When that stops, that is the experience of Nibbana. The letting go that will make the difference in a very short thought. I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. If you mean that momentary realization, yeah, it's this final, it's the ignition, really. But you've generally worked quite hard to get to that point. But it's the point where the mind shifts. Like you have this, suppose you have this tree that has fallen into the mud, no? So you want to pick it up and have it fall the other way. Well, eventually it gets to the apex and starts to fall in the other direction. So all of our work is just to get it to that point so that it falls in the other direction. The mind shifts and recoils in a sense, or not recoils, but releases. And it's that releasing or that letting go. But it comes as a result of seeing. Really, the key is not the letting go. The key is the seeing clearly. When you see clearly, the mind automatically lets go. So we're working to see clearer and clearer until that moment where the mind, you know, it's just like full bright, and the mind shifts. Hope that helps. Well, if there are other questions, I'm happy to be here. Otherwise, we can call it a day. Tomorrow we have, if people have questions, always the good questions always come on the Sundays, right? So tomorrow we'll have our radio broadcast at radio.sirimangalo.org. And there you can ask questions about pretty much anything that relates to Buddhism, meditation, or the monastic life. We also, for those of you who haven't been to the radio broadcasts, we also have this formal retaking of our determination. I don't know the best, I don't want to say ceremony because it's not really ceremonial, but it's formal. Formal taking of refuge, where we make a determination that we are following this path and that we take the Buddha as our guide. It's just a very traditional, and I guess in most circles it's ceremonial. But we're just calling it formal. And you can partake or not partake. It's just this chanting that we do. But it's not really chanting, it's this recital of refuges and also precepts. So we make a determination to keep the moral training precepts, either 5 or 8. So we do that first, and you're welcome to skip that or join that as you like. And then after that we have questions and answers. You question, I answer. And then after that, a bit of group meditation. So everyone's welcome there. Again, it's at radio.sirimangalo.org. And there are advertisements there, unfortunately. We aren't getting the ad money. It goes to ustream.tv. That's the host. But there are ways to get around the ads. If you look, if you're using Firefox or Chrome, you can download Adblock and block the ads. Otherwise, just put up with them. And so I guess I'll hopefully see some of you or all of you tomorrow. Just give a few more minutes if people have questions. Please don't be shy. Otherwise, thank you all for coming. I was thinking we could also do some kind of formal opening and closing, because you're supposed to. If we were in a Buddhist, well, we are in a Buddhist country. If we were in a traditionally Buddhist circle, we would have to do these formal openings and closings. So I was thinking we could do something formal. I mean, it would just mean me at the beginning paying homage to the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha, something like that. Just be like 5 seconds or 10 seconds or something. And everyone else at home could think like that, or could offer up their respects and their homage. And then at the end here, we could make a determination that the goodness that has come from our study, that it be for the betterment of the world, and that we make a wish. You know? Because like meditation, study of the Dhamma is a good thing, something that helps us to purify our minds. Hopefully this is something that we're taking to heart now, no? And these are teachings that are going to improve our way of life. So as a result, it's goodness. And goodness has power. So as a result, we can make a wish for this power to have, you know, a determination, really, that this power may work for the betterment of others. So I'd like, maybe let's start that now, and we'll just take a few minutes here, to a few moments anyway, to make a wish. We can all close our eyes. We can also do a bit of meditation if we like. Let's do, you know, 5 minutes, okay? And during that time, you don't have to practice vipassana. You can also use the time to reflect and to send your good thoughts to other beings and wish for all beings to be happy and so on. And make your determination and wish. So we'll do 5 minutes now. Okay. Yeah, great. It's certainly good to see so much interest. Thanks everyone for coming, and see you all next time.